committee Southfoot to allow Mark make those remarks this morning. I've always been told I'm always bringing up the rear. Today, it's I want to thank Brother John for allowing me to have the class first, because we hope to get on our way. It's not just that I want to be first. And because I'm first, I won't have to keep you in suspense about, maybe I might tell you a little story. So Chuck, you can rest easy. This little perusal that we have had of the Sermon on the Mount, I will be the first to admit that it has been very superficial. And those of you who would accuse me of glossing over many of the areas and not going into great detail on them, I will acknowledge you're right. But what we have tried to do in this look at the Sermon on the Mount is to try, as we have indicated all the way through, to recognize that what Jesus is demanding in this policy speech is that those that would follow him had to do it with the right spirit and the right attitude. And the only way that we could ever possibly hope to measure up to the loftiness of the concepts that are in the principles of the Beatitudes is by having a right attitude of our own unworthiness. Once we get to the position where we think we are great, or we are to be reckoned with, or we are to be noted, or we are to be heard, or whatever the rationale you want to use, whenever we get to that position, we have the right attitude. When we think we're something, look out. Now, having set that as the premise, as I see the Sermon on the Mount, which warrants a much deeper and concerted study than what we have given it this week, we will continue with the hope that we can come to some sort of a conclusion as a result of the things that Jesus has said in this talk that he has given of principles of behavior. In the 12th chapter of the 12th verse of the 7th chapter, he talks about the golden rule. Well, if people remember, and I'm talking about most outside people that know little or nothing about the teachings of Jesus, if they remember anything of the Sermon on the Mount, it is this golden rule. And it's a tremendous principle. But again, it is predicated upon a proper attitude. If you will do to others what you expect to do to them, or have them do to you, or do for you, you first of all have to be prepared to extend that courtesy to them. See, it isn't the other way on. You have to make the step. If you want others to do for you what you would like, you must first do it for them. You know, we like to get it the other way on, don't we? You know, I'll respond in kind. It's the nature of the beast. And in doing this, Jesus tells us that the principles of the law and the prophets would be fulfilled. That if you would do unto men what you would have them do unto you. Our brother spoke this morning briefly on the entering in on the straight gate, which is the next thought. For wide is the gate and broad is the way that leadeth to destruction, and many there be that go in thereat. Because straight is the gate and narrow is the way that will lead unto life, and few there will be that find it. He's speaking of a principle here. One of the writers suggests that at the time of Jesus, that he was speaking of something that they were all aware of, the broad way and the narrow. One has suggested that as one went into Jerusalem, there was a broad road, wide road, that led down to Gehenna, or that area, and to get to the temple or the place of worship, it was necessary to break off that road and go up a rather steep way or steep path, which indicated that to break off the broad, which was the easy way, which led to Gehenna in type, and go up the other, it involved a little bit of effort. The word strive to get onto that road means to, originally, to agonize. It requires an effort. And an effort to do that which is difficult requires an attitude to do it. You see, it doesn't come naturally to do things that we don't like. It's the very opposite. And if something is restrictive and it is going to forbid us certain privileges, or the way demands an effort on our part, we tend to shun it. We as humans pick the easy way. And so this is the principle that he's talking about here, that if we're going to get into God's kingdom, in essence, then we must avoid the easy way. We can't float into the kingdom. It must be by effort, and a concerted effort, predicated upon an attitude to serve God pleasingly. We next come to the 15th verse of this 7th chapter that has to do with false prophets, which come in to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravening wolves. You realize again, as we said several times during our talks, that obviously these messages were intended for those who were the apostles, not the broad multitude. Therefore, what he is talking about in this particular area is a group of people who have dedicated themselves to serve God along the means he has prescribed, or ways. And into that assembly, or into that group, will come people whom he speaks of as false prophets, false teachers, ones who would have a wolf attitude. Now, a wolf, as you know, is a predator. He eats the weak, and he eats the infirm. He eats those things that are sick and maimed, and he tends to wreak havoc wherever he goes. Sheep, on the other hand, are sort of docile animals and readily handled. The illustration of Christ at his sacrifice, when it says of him that he was as a sheep that opened not its mouth before the shearers, Christ went meekly, quietly to that role which God had laid out for him as a lamb of sacrifice for the world. The contrast between the sheep and the wolf, as illustrated here, is to indicate the difference in personalities, or intentions, or attitude. Now, it's peculiar to me, and I haven't been able to get a true handle on this, These people who are considered here as wolves, the message, of course, is given as a warning, as to be alerted to the fact that into this group of people who had dedicated their lives to the Lord, there would be those who would come in under false pretenses. What I can't get a handle on, and I'll be perfectly frank with you, is I have never been able to quite associate somebody who has learned the truth, who comes in with the intention of being a wolf. Now, I can see the wolf aspect developing after, but coming in as a wolf clothed in sheep clothing indicate to me that this individual had the intention of being disruptive long before he made a commitment to be in that group. Now, maybe you have the answer for it. I don't. Obviously, there must have been that type, or the possibility of that type, or Jesus would not have given this warning. I don't think it's necessary for us to explore where these people come from. I think that's the expression of the day, their attitude. But rather, be alerted to the fact that there is this possibility. And if someone is going around biting and mutilating and destroying the sheep, then we have been warned that this could happen. Now, you notice that Jesus doesn't say anything in here how we ought to defense against this, excepting to be aware that it is a possibility. And when it comes, we're not to be alarmed, or shall we say, no, that isn't the right word I should use, not be surprised that it has come. So we are, by this injunction, to be ready for the possibility that this sort of a wolf will sneak into the assembled group who have dedicated their lives to the Lord. Now, how do you find these people? Do you look behind their ears, or tell them to open their mouth, and let's see what their claws look like? Is that how you check them out? Well, I'm being a little bit of verbose. I'm trying to be funny when I say those things. No, Jesus says you can judge that wolf by what he does. Like a tree, you judge a tree by what it produces. You wouldn't expect to get a nice Louisiana plum from one of these briars that grow out here. On the other hand, you wouldn't expect a Louisiana plum tree to give you one of these briars in its branches, thorns. So when you look at people who are in the assembly dedicated to their, supposedly dedicated to the service of the Lord, you know them by their behavior or what they produce. The fruits of the Spirit, of course, are indicated in Galatians. For sake of time, we won't look them up, but I think you're all aware of them. You're also aware there of the indications which show whether the man is motivated by the principles of serving God or serving flesh. Galatians 5 is a chapter that deals with those things. And having established those principles to discern by what a man does, that is the measuring stick that we use to assert whether an individual is a wolf or whether he is a lamb intending on serving the Lord. Now, by their fruits ye shall know them. There's nothing in here to indicate what he does or what he suggests doing with these wolves that have been defrocked, as it were. Their sheepskin pulled off and their teeth exposed. It's a defense mechanism that he is suggesting in here. If you know that there's going to be, or the possibility of a problem, you defense for it and fortify yourself that you will not be persuaded or interfered with or harmed by the intention of that wolf. And the wolf will make himself manifest. We have a saying that if you give an individual enough rope, he'll hang himself. The inference is that by what a person does, you will very quickly find out what has motivated them. And then you guard against their influence. In industry, I'm going to talk here for a moment about the idea of detection. In industry, there is a tool that they use. It's called the Y critique. Some of you have probably heard of it. It's a tool in industry to try to get to the root of the problem. If you have a problem in production, you assemble your production crew, and then you begin by asking a series of questions. Why? Why are we not getting the number of cars off the end of this assembly line that we should? Well, it's because we have an operator down there that isn't functioning properly. Well, why isn't this operator functioning properly? Well, he got up late, or he's having trouble at home. Well, you know, you can go on and on. And eventually, you narrow down by the why critique the problem. And it can be applied to many things. It can be applied to ourselves. It could be applied to individuals in our ecclesia. Why are there people who have this wolf attitude in our group? We've been warned that they'll come. We're not surprised when they show up. But the thing is, why? What makes them tick, as it were? I suggest to you that they are wolves seeking self-gratification, attention. If you narrow it down, it comes to that this individual is motivated by the principle of self-gratification. And it's something that all of us have to fight. The wolf in the sheep's clothing has a cover-up. He's a play actor. He's a hypocrite. He can be many things. He can even be ourselves. If we are there in the role of a servant of Christ in a cloak for the purpose of self-aggrandizement, the mind can play real tricks on us if we let it. We mentioned rationalization and so on. You see, he says the false prophet or the wolf comes in to you. And he doesn't say exactly where he comes from or when he will come, but he surely will come. And so therefore, where he comes from is really a result of the attitude and the thinking of that individual. Having been warned to guard against this, our premise then is to be alert, judging people by what they do, and that will in turn detect their attitudes. All right. Verse 21. Everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven. Pardon me. Not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of my Father which is in heaven. We were talking yesterday about where in the Sermon on the Mount does Jesus say that he will be the judge in the last days, and this is at least one of the areas. He's indicating in this verse that he will be the judge at the last day. He nominates at the very beginning of his ministry that he will be the judge. He that saith to me, Lord, Lord, at that day, which is the day of judgment, simply by professing to be a follower of Jesus, verbalizing, is not credential enough or credit enough to get into God's kingdom. The premise is, as his half-brother James says, he must be a doer of the law. And Jesus said, he that doeth the will of my Father will be in God's kingdom. Many will say to me in that day, again, the fact that he is to be judge, we've done a lot of good things in your name. We've been to Bible schools, we've rooted out wolves, we've done this and that and the other thing. There's an indication in here of attitude. He that doeth the will of my Father, which is in heaven, will enter into the kingdom. Is the will of the Father to prophesy in his name, cast out devils, and done many wonderful works? Are they not the will of the Father? Well, why is the one disqualified in this little discourse and the other not, if it's not to do with the attitude? The attitude of the one who cites his great works is to indicate that God is indebted to him. You see, that's an attitudinal problem. You see, we can't make God, no matter how we may want to maneuver, we can't make him indebted to us. I use the us as a way of speaking. It's a Pharisaical attitude. You know, you thump your hand on your chest or pat yourself on the back, say, what a great guy I am. I do this, I do that, and boy, I've been here and I've been there and so on. We tend to indicate that God is indebted to us for how much we've done. Well, we don't have to get into a discussion of to whether God's indebted to us or whether we're indebted to him. We're all fully persuaded that we are in God's debt, and we can't subsist without him. We have no hope for the future without him, and therefore before him we are as nothing. But if we try to infer by the things we do that we are putting God in debt to us, we've got the wrong attitude. Those that do that, Christ will say in the day, I don't know you. you're not the same mind as me. I was willing to do what the Father required of me because I was motivated out of love. I was motivated out of the idea of being serviceable to my Father. But if you think that by doing those things you perceive to be God's will, that you're the same mind as me, and that you are doing it to establish, I think they use a term sometimes in the accounting world, of brownie points. You know, girls in the brownies get sort of little badges. Well, if maybe you don't have brownies down here. They're Girl Scouts, how's that? If you can get these little badges, have shown some growth or progress, some things you've accomplished. If one in this life tries to bargain, as it were, with God out of the things they've done to make their place sure out of a point of being God obligated to them, then obviously the attitude is wrong. Therefore, whosoever heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them, I will liken him unto a wise man which buildeth his house upon a rock. A man, the matter of that which was discussed earlier when we talked about the principles of poor spirit, the principle of mourning, and the principle of meekness, and that of hungering and thirsting after righteousness. This is the foundation of attitude that is necessary that a man may build a character or a house that would be acceptable place of protection, if I can use that word, in the days to come, because this is the comparison that Jesus makes further in this little discussion that he has in relation to the building. He says that a man that builds on solid principles will build a house that will withstand the problems that will come assuredly to that individual in the days that will come. He goes on and he says, the rain descended and the floods came and the winds blew and beat upon that house, and it fell not, for it was founded upon a rock. And then we go on and he talks about that everyone that heareth the sayings of mine and doeth them not, and everyone that heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them not shall be likened unto a foolish man which built his house upon the sand. Now the contrast here is between the wise man and the foolish man. The contrast also goes to the fact that both obviously are builders. The contrast also suggests that one builds on the rock and the other builds on sand. And the indication that Jesus is making here, among many other deeper things, is the fact that the place or the foundation on which an individual builds is the criteria by which one will know whether or not the building will stand. Rock as opposed to sand. Rock is solid, sand shifts, moves. Those that are built upon the principles that Christ indicated in this parable, would, at least in this sermon and the Beatitudes, is reckoned as a firm foundation like bedrock. It will not move. We could expand on that to the point where we could say the foundation of the hope of one who is have of a proper attitude are the promises. And those things that were given by God in assurance and covenant to those who would serve him. That is the foundation rock of our faith. And without it, any edifice that is built upon it, namely an edifice of character, will be stable. It's not going to be shifting, and it's not going to be moving all the time from the principle that it is grounded upon in its foundation. On the other hand, there are those who would start out to build this rock without a clear and firm foundation. Perhaps their ability to comprehend the value of a good understanding, which is equivalent to knowing that firm foundation on which the house is to be built. But there are those who build upon a poor foundation, just as there is in the building business. At home, I shudder when I go through some of the surveys that are being built in our area. You know, the land will have a rolling terrain, and what they'll do, they'll bring bulldozers in and earth movers, and they'll level it all off. They fill the valleys and they cut off the tops. Now they run through with compactors and so on, with the idea that the ground will be compacted in the lower areas so that there will be some stability. But when the rain descends and the floods come and the winds blow and beat upon those houses, that land that is supposed to have been compacted has no stability in it. And these houses will develop cracks, and the foundations will splinter, and the house will be a poor investment. This is the same sort of a suggestion that is being made in this parable that Jesus is giving here. That it is possible to build on an incorrect foundation. Otherwise, he wouldn't have said it. So therefore, it is necessary for those that are the true followers of Jesus and his following in his footsteps in service to the Lord, that they have the right foundation as centered in the promises that we had already inferred. Now we come to another inference that this parable suggests. Remember, this is a principle that Jesus is laying down that all who would be his followers must recognize, a principle. And the principle is that if you're going to build your house, and hopefully it's on the rock, and that is up to you, or us, or me, when the rain comes and the floods come and the wind blows, what is he suggesting? He's suggesting a period when the stability of that building is going to be tested. You notice that he doesn't say when a man comes up and pushes on the house, or when somebody starts to pry off a board off the siding, or whether somebody starts to cut a hole in your roof. The illustrations of the testing indicate that they are centered in the Lord, because who else but God has control over the rain and the floods and the wind? So the suggestion is that the trials and the tribulations that will test the house that is being built are from God. And this is not a new principle. Certainly, if... let's just look at one that that you can put in your file. And it's a principle that is borne out by the scriptures, but one that is easy to see. My son, well, this is Proverbs 3 and starts at verse 5. Honor the Lord with thy substance, with the first fruits of thine increase. Again, back to this parable that was used earlier. My son, despise, pardon me, so shall thy barns be filled with plenty, and thy presses shall burst out with new wine. My son, despise not thou the chastening of the Lord, neither be weary of his correction. For whom the Lord loveth, he correcteth, even as the father the son in whom he delighteth. And he goes on, happy is the man that finds wisdom. The principle is that the trials on our house will be God-oriented. Now, sometimes, most times, the chastening of the Lord is not pleasant. The testing of the house, the stability of the house. But let me tell you something. There is a hope that if the foundation is correct, that the period of testing will be weathered. We are assured that the testing is to prove our worth. And once that is established, the testing will ease off. There's something else that we ought to be aware of. God spoke of sifting the nation of Israel. Now, sifting is done in several ways. Sifting is done to separate the chaff from the wheat. The sifting is done in some cases that the bad falls out and the good stays in. The screen or the method of separating is devised for that purpose of separation. And in Amos 9:9, if you want to write it down and look it up later, God talks about how he sifted Israel. And he said that none, the inference is in that particular verse, that none of the good would be lost. The good seed wouldn't go through the screen. It's something to think about. If the foundation of one who is attempting to serve the Lord is correct, even in the period of sifting, difficult and harsh as it may be, and emotionally draining and straining, the good won't fall through. Something to think about. But the test will come, and let me tell you something that I'm totally convinced of. That we'll be tested in the areas in which we are the most vulnerable. We're not going to be tested where we're strong, because there's no test. We're going to be tested where we're the weakest. And it's like a piece of machinery. You can have a great piece of machinery, but the weak link is what causes the piece of machinery to break down. So in our characters, our dispositions, the area that is most likely to crack is the area wherein we're the weakest. And we're all going to be tested, and we're know, as we indicated from Amos 9:9, that the good grain or the good wheat will not be lost. Sometimes in sizing of grain and appraising its quality, it's often forced through sizers, as it were. Number one, grain is a certain size, and it's a certain dryness, and it's all various things are used to measure it. But when that grain is measured to its rating, let me put it that way, it has to be forced through something that determines its size, whether or not it meets the standard. You can also think of that in the sense of the testing that we go through. We're drawn, as it were, through a knot, as this expression is used sometimes. And it's to determine the quality or the size or the capacity, whatever you want to phrase it, of that which is being tested. The testing will come. Those that are right, on the right foundation will weather the storm. It won't be easy. The wind shakes the house, and it rattles the windows, and the boards may flap on the side, and the glass in the window may give a tinkling sound. The analogies you can see, apply it to ourselves. Our house will be shaken, and it'll rattle. And we'll be shaken right to our foundation with some of the things that we are called upon to bear. But if the foundation is correct, if the attitude is right, if our attitude is selflessness and a dedication to serve God as His Son showed us in His example, we'll weather the storm. The house won't fall, and it'll stand, and it'll be something that will be of value, a place of refuge, a place of comfort to those that have survived, if I can put it that way. Because that house, which is the analogy of an individual, that house can be a source of inspiration to others in the ecclesia. If you look on a member house in your ecclesia that has endured great things and still remain firm and dedicated with an attitude of serving God acceptably, aren't they an inspiration to all of us? Aren't they that kind of an example that you don't look as a ravening wolf, but as a stabling influence in the ecclesia? These are at least some of the things that we can glean from the Sermon on the Mount. I've said to you, I feel that I have treated this subject superficially. I feel that there's a great deal more that all of us can get out of it. I hope when you go to your homes that you will further study it. I'm not that naive that I think that I've motivated you. I am aware of human nature. I realize that when we get away from this building, as our brother indicated this morning, that we run out of gas. Our enthusiasm is great now, and we're maybe saying to ourselves, yes, I will look into these things. I wouldn't be the least surprised if very few, if any, of you do. No, I'm not saying that to your shame. I know how we are. But hopefully you will. And I would hope that you would look at the Sermon on the Mount, again, as we said, with the idea of determining our attitudes. What do I say at the end? And I'm not cutting this short purposely. I have had many things that I intended to say, and haven't. There's many, many things that I should have said and haven't. Hopefully, as a result of this effort, we'll go home, perhaps with a little different attitude to our own capacities. Now, you remember very early in the discussions that we had, we said that the principles that are contained in the Sermon on the Mount, that they are so serious that those who have the right attitude are assured that theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And the warning is there that if our righteousness would not exceed that of the Pharisees, there was no chance that we could get into the kingdom of God. Remember that I also said, and you may think this is rather strange that I should bring this in here, and I do it, I believe, to make a point. You all related readily to the fact that I said that I was not Jimmy Swaggart. And a lot of you will remember this class because I said I was not Jimmy Swaggart. And whenever you think of me, you will probably think of Jimmy Swaggart. I hope when you do that, that you will remember that I also said that I felt that if the Christadelphians were not able to get into the kingdom of God, it would not be because of a doctrinal problem, but because of a wrong attitude.